So you send a text,
Okay.
and an hour goes by. Nothing. 2 hours. Still nothing.
Oh, I know this feeling.
Right. By hour three, you haven't just, noticed the silence. You have basically written an entire script in your head where this person is furiously angry with you.
Yeah, they're reevaluating your entire friendship.
Exactly. They're probably talking about you behind your back to all your mutual friends. And I mean, what is physically and computationally happening in your brain when you do that?
It's a lot. A whole lot of wasted energy, honestly.
Right. And more importantly, how do you shut it off?
Yeah.
So, welcome to today's deep dive. We are unpacking paper three from the July 2026 Cognitive Dynamics Corpus.
The one titled Dual Observation Dynamics.
That's the one. Our mission today is to map out this exact transition from just observing the physical world to suddenly becoming like completely trapped in a simulation of how the world observes us.
Yeah, and this transition going from first-order world modeling to second-order meta-observation is exactly where social cognition either succeeds or just completely derails.
Derails is definitely the right word for the text message scenario.
For sure, because first order is just simply interacting with the environment, right? The event happens.
Just the facts.
Right. But meta-observation is your brain suddenly attempting to model the mind of the observer who's watching the event. And this is the kicker, projecting a version of yourself into that model.
Okay, let's unpack this. Let's ground that conceptual shift on what the brain is actually doing.
Yeah.
Because first-order observation, to me, is like playing a highly demanding video game.
Oh, I like that analogy.
Right. You are managing your health bar, you're navigating the map, reacting to obstacles, you're allocating all your cognitive RAM to processing the objective external data of the game.
Yeah, it's pure environmental interaction. You are the subject, the game is the object.
Exactly. Now, meta-observation activates when, say, someone walks into the room and just stands right behind your chair to watch you play.
Oh, instantly stressful.
Right. The game itself hasn't changed at all,
Yeah.
but your cognitive processing instantly fractures. You are no longer just rendering the map. You are now rendering a simulation of the observer watching you.
You're trying to calculate, like, do they think my strategy is optimal?
Yes. Do they notice that mistake I just made? Do they think I'm actually good at this?
So your console is suddenly trying to run two extremely demanding programs at the exact same time.
And running them on the same hardware,
Yeah.
which just lags everything out.
Yeah, and that processing load is what this paper formalizes so incredibly well because our brains don't just run two programs. We're actually building four distinct representations of reality.
Four.
Four. And often we're running them simultaneously. If we map out your unanswered text message scenario chronologically, we can actually see the computational load pile up.
Okay, walk me through the timeline.
So at minute one, you simply have the world model.
Right.
This is the neutral objective event. A message was sent. Zero replies have been received.
Just the raw telemetry data, nothing else.
Exactly. But then you layer on the self model. This is your internal biological and psychological state. So maybe your heart rate elevates slightly. You feel a tiny spike of cortisol. You realize I am experiencing anticipation.
And I feel like that's usually where the facts stop and the fiction begins.
Pretty much. Because hour two rolls around and we are forced to generate the third representation, which is the other model.
Because we can't see what they're actually doing.
Right. We have to construct a theory of their hidden state. So we think, oh, they were probably stuck in a meeting or maybe they left their phone in the car.
Which is still somewhat rational.
It is. But that leads directly into the critical point of failure in social cognition, the fourth representation.
The self-projection and the other's model.
Yes. You stop rendering what they might be doing, and you start rendering how you think they are representing you in their mind.
And that's when the thought morphs from they're busy to they think I'm too needy for texting twice.
Exactly. Or they're ignoring me because they don't respect my time.
The real chaos here, reading through the paper, is how seamlessly the brain just blurs the first representation with the fourth.
Oh, completely.
Like, we treat the objective world model, the silent phone, as if it's mathematically identical to the self-projection that they think I'm annoying.
We treat our assumption as an absolute fact.
Right. But the text message is just a blank screen. It's a total absence of data.
Yeah.
Yet the brain jumps from this simple fact to a highly detailed, emotionally devastating conclusion.
Yeah.
I mean, if the data isn't there, why are we generating an outcome at all?
Well, you're hitting on what the corpus defines as the inverse problem in social cognition.
The inverse problem.
Yeah. So in mathematics, an inverse problem is when you try to calculate the causal factors that produced a specific set of observations.
Okay, give me a visual for that.
Think of deducing the exact 3D shape of an object purely by looking at its 2D shadow on the wall.
Oh, like hand puppets.
Exactly like hand puppets. In human interaction, observable behavior, so the delayed text or a slight frown from someone across the room, a really short email, all of that is just the shadow.
Right.
The hidden psychological state that actually casts that shadow is entirely invisible to us.
And there are a million different objects that could cast the exact same shadow.
Right. A delayed text could be caused by a dead battery, a minor car accident, a crazy busy day at work, or, sure, deep personal animosity.
The causal pathways are practically infinite.
They are. And because the hidden state is invisible and those pathways are infinite, the brain is faced with a massive computational problem.
It's trying to solve for X with way too many variables.
Exactly. And evolutionarily speaking, the brain utterly despises ambiguity.
Because ambiguity is dangerous.
Huge danger. In an ancestral environment, not knowing the hidden social state of your tribe members is physically risky.
Mm.
If the person looking at you from across the fire is angry and you just sit around waiting for more data to confirm it,
you might be exiled. Or worse.
Right. You get killed. So ambiguity is treated as a predator.
So the brain forces a conclusion to eliminate the threat of the unknown. Like, even if the conclusion is terrible, they hate me, it's somehow better than uncertainty.
Yes. The paper refers to this mechanism as single hypothesis locking.
Single hypothesis locking.
Yeah. When we're faced with the inverse problem of a silent phone, we don't hold the 5 or 6 most logical possibilities in a state of suspended probability.
We don't just say, it could be a dead battery or they hate me, let's wait and see.
No. We rapidly abandon the benign explanations and we lock onto one specific hypothesis. We optimize for certainty over accuracy.
Okay, but if the shadow on the wall gives us 0 actual clues about which object is casting it, how does the brain decide which hypothesis to lock onto?
That's a $1 million question.
Right. If I decide they're ignoring me because I'm annoying, where is the data for that conclusion coming from?
It comes from projection error.
Projection error.
Yeah, this is a crucial insight of the dual observation framework. Your self-projection, remember, that fourth model is heavily dictated by your internal Bayesian prior.
Well, your priors, like your past experiences.
Exactly. Your brain is essentially a prediction engine. When it lacks external data, it pulls from its own historical archive to fill in the blanks.
Wow. So it's literally using past baggage to write the script for the current moment.
It uses your baseline self-esteem, your history of attachment, past relational traumas, even your current metabolic state.
Wait. Metabolic state, like how tired you are.
Yes. If you are exhausted and already feeling inadequate, your priors dictate that a delayed text must be a rejection.
Oh, that makes so much sense.
The external signal is just a 3-hour silence. But your brain projects this vivid, high-definition movie onto that silence, and the director of that movie is your own internalized history.
So if it's a projection, then the environment isn't really the trigger at all.
No.
The trigger is when the environment fails to match our internal expectation. We expected a text back in 5 minutes. It didn't arrive. That prediction error creates a vacuum, and our own anxiety just rushes in to fill it.
And once that vacuum is open, the brain doesn't just stop at one layer of assumption.
Right.
To resolve the prediction error, it initiates a process of recursive inference.
Here's where it gets really interesting. The mental spiral.
Oh, yeah, the spiral.
Let's map out the architecture of that spiral for the listener. Level 1 is the first order observation. I see him frown.
Okay.
Level 2 is the other model.
Uh-huh.
I assume he is mad.
Right.
But then level 3 introduces the recursions. I guess he knows that I know he's mad.
And then level 4 drops you even further into the rabbit hole. He knows that I know that he knows he's mad.
It's exhausting just saying it out loud. We start playing a game of multidimensional chess against a ghost.
It is exhausting. And for decades, early psychological frameworks, especially those relying on like static theory of mind tests, they assumed that humans hit a hard computational ceiling at recursion depth.
Like we literally couldn't process past a certain point.
Yeah, the consensus back in the late 90s and 2000s was that brains generally cap out at 3 or 4 levels of this I know that you know loop. Before the processing just breaks down entirely.
But those older theories were based on logic puzzles in a lab, right? Not real-world social stakes.
Exactly. The July 2026 corpus argues that recursion depth isn't a fixed hardware limitation at all. It's actually a dynamic variable.
Dynamic meaning it changes based on the situation.
Yes. It models depth as a function of three competing variables: task value, cognitive resources, and error growth.
Okay, break those down.
So if you are interacting with someone who holds immense social or professional value to, you say, a new romantic partner or your boss, the stakes are super high.
Task value is high.
Right. Your brain will aggressively allocate a much larger cognitive budget to dig deeper into that recursive spiral. It will attempt to simulate 5, 6, or even 7 levels deep.
Under the assumption that if I just throw more processing power at the problem, if I just think about it harder and deeper, I will eventually calculate the objective truth of what they are thinking.
Which leads to the absolute most dangerous trap outlined in the paper. The metacognitive illusion.
This part blew my mind.
It's wild. The illusion is defined by a very specific formula in the text. Confidence minus accuracy.
Confidence minus accuracy. Yeah. So if I'm spending huge amounts of metabolic energy mapping out a 6-level deep simulation of my boss's mind, my confidence in my conclusion is going to be incredibly high.
Off the charts.
It's essentially the sunk cost fallacy applied to cognitive effort.
Hmm.
The brain assumes that because it works so incredibly hard on the model just must be correct.
Exactly. Your confidence skyrockets, but your accuracy is simultaneously plummeting towards zero.
Because of the third variable.
Yeah.
Error growth.
Yes. Think of error growth like a neurological game of telephone.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
Because of the inverse problem, your level 2 assumption, he's a mad, is an unverified guess. So when you build level 3, he knows I know, he's mad, you are building a guess entirely on top of another guess.
The signal-to-noise ratio completely degrades. Every single layer of recursion takes the tiny margin of error from the previous layer and compounds it exponentially.
Until there's no signal left. By the time you reach level 4 or 5, the model consists almost entirely of noise. You have departed entirely from objective reality.
Wow.
Yet, because of that heavy computational investment, you feel a profound sense of certainty.
So you aren't uncovering reality at all. You are generating a highly detailed, deeply flawed fiction, and your brain is chemically rewarding you for believing it.
That is the metacognitive illusion in a nutshell. It's the vast gap between how certain you feel and how wildly inaccurate you actually are.
You know, that reframes the entire experience of overthinking for me.
How so?
Because when you are caught in that spiral, it feels permanent. Historically, philosophers like Sartre treated this as the ultimate human condition.
Oh, the existential dread.
Exactly. They framed it as an ontological curse. The idea that humans are biologically and philosophically condemned to suffer under the gaze of the other. Like we are permanently trapped observing ourselves through someone else's eyes.
Yeah. The older paradigms really treated meta-observation as this heavy, inescapable anchor attached to human consciousness, a permanent state of being.
But this paper flips that entirely.
Completely dismantles it. The breakthrough in dual observation dynamics is that it replaces all that philosophical dread with a mechanical, resource-driven framework. Meta-observation is not an ontological curse.
It is a situational, conditional mechanism.
Yes, it's a localized application of processing power.
And if it's a mechanism, it requires fuel. And if it requires fuel, it can run out of fuel.
That's the secret. The brain operates on a strict metabolic budget. Running a second-order, multi-level, recursive simulation of another human's mind requires massive engagement from the default mode network.
Which is the network responsible for self-referential thought and, like, mental time travel.
Exactly. But the default mode network is notoriously anti-correlated with the task-positive network.
Okay, what's the task-positive network?
That's the network that activates when you are intensely focused on a demanding external first-order task.
Ah. So they operate on a neural seesaw.
They do. You literally cannot fund both at maximum capacity simultaneously.
So going back to the video game analogy, if you try to render the face of the person watching you play, the frame rate of the actual game drops.
Yep, the game starts lagging.
But crucially, the reverse is also true. If you force the console to render an incredibly complex, high-definition first-order environment, it has to shut down the simulation of the observer just to free up the RAM.
Exactly. You can actively starve the recursive loop.
You defund the simulation.
Yes. If the toggle switch for meta-observation is flipped on by prediction errors and social ambiguity, it can be forcibly flipped off by cognitive resource depletion.
By engaging heavily in a first-order task.
Right. Something that demands high spatial awareness, physical coordination, or intense sensory processing. You withdraw the metabolic budget from the default mode network.
So the brain drops the multi-level simulation because it literally cannot afford the ATP and neural bandwidth required to run it.
While you are, for example, navigating a difficult climbing route or learning a complex piece of music or doing intense mathematics.
That is a staggering realization. We don't have to philosophize our way out of social anxiety.
No, you don't.
We don't have to somehow outthink the recursive spiral because thinking is the exact mechanism causing the problem. We just have to reallocate the budget.
You cannot solve a metacognitive illusion by applying more metacognition. You solve it by returning to the world model.
So what does this all mean? Let's synthesize the architecture of what we've unpacked today from the July 2026 corpus.
Sure.
We start with the first order world model, just tracking objective events. A prediction error occurs, a delayed text, an ambiguous glance, and we jump to second order meta observation.
And faced with the inverse problem of not knowing the hidden causal state, our brains lock onto a single hypothesis to escape the threat of ambiguity.
We use our own historical baggage to dictate projection errors, filling the silence with our own insecurities.
And we take those projections and spin them into recursive loops, level after level of, I know that you know that I know.
The error growth compounds, the noise totally overwhelms the signal. But our cognitive effort creates this metacognitive illusion where we feel absolutely certain about a completely fictitious scenario.
But as we just established, we ultimately arrive at the mechanism of escape. Meta-observation is not a permanent curse.
It is a highly expensive computational process running on a limited cognitive budget.
Right. By forcing our attention into demanding first-order tasks, we can toggle the mechanism off by starving it of resources.
It's a completely mechanical solution to what feels like an insurmountable emotional problem.
It really is.
But before we wrap up, I want to leave you, the listener, with one final, slightly provocative thought to mull over.
Oh, I have a good one for this, actually.
Lay it on me.
So we've talked entirely about your brain spinning this complex, exhausting simulation about why someone hasn't texted you back.
Right.
But consider the other side of that silent phone. What if, while you are burning massive amounts of energy running a level 5 simulation of why they are ignoring you, they aren't actually ignoring you at all?
What are they doing?
What if they typed out a reply, overanalyzed it, deleted it, and are now sitting there running their own exhausting level 5 simulation about how you're going to judge their text?
Oh, wow.
What if that 3-hour delay is just two people locked in their own isolated metacognitive illusions, entirely terrified of what the other is thinking, and neither one is actually interacting with the real world?
That is both hilarious and deeply tragic.
It really is.
So the next time you find yourself paralyzed by the thought of what someone else is thinking about you, sitting on your couch staring at a phone that hasn't buzzed in 3 hours, remember the computational reality of your situation.
Defund the simulation.
Exactly. Redirect your RAM, find a complex first-order task, engage with the objective environment, and just try to observe the world at level 1 today. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive.